Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
So days after the anti-establishment five-star movement and the anti-immigrant league walked away from a bid to form a coalition Italian government, according to a senior state official, the president of Italy wants to find out whether they're ready to revive it. Joining us now, I'm really pleased to say, is Luigi Zingales, Chicago Booth School Finance Professor, and he joins us on the phone. Professor Zingales, it was started by a president who gave legitimacy to an idea that wasn't clearly on the agenda at the time. It's a curious event that's taken place in Italy, Luigi.
Yes, it is. I think that I agree with you that was the president that spooked the market more than the populist. The fact that he raised the issue of the euro exit and made us think out of not appointing somebody as finance minister really created a lot of uncertainty. I don't know what is going to happen. Really, the situation is very much in flux now.
So, Professor, the key question, I think, for markets that everyone should be looking out for is whether we get a new election, one, and two, what kind of platform do these two parties run on in that election? Is it clear to you, Luigi, that if we had another election in Italy, that those two parties would run on a platform to leave the Eurozone?
No, I don't think that they will run on that platform. I think it would be suicidal, honestly, to have a campaign on that front, because people will start running to get their money out of the bank as the ballots are counted. So I don't think they will do it. I think that the Democratic Party will try to train them to run a campaign in that direction, because it is in his interest to do that. But I don't think this will happen.
So for anyone worrying, Professor, about an existential crisis in Europe, once again, what's your message to them at this point?
So I think that we are always in an existential crisis. I think that the problems of Italy indicate that the euro is not a well-designed system. And I think that everybody knows it, but nobody has the courage to say. It's a bit like the emperor has no clothes. And we need to fix it. The question is there willingness to fix it? And if there is not willing to fix it, Stein who used to say, if something's not sustainable, eventually will not be sustained. And I'm stating the obvious, but eventually will not be sustained. Whether it is because of the five-star movement or because of this or because of that, that's sort of an accident. The substance is we need to fix it.
Right. Luigi, wonderful to have you on in this time of turmoil in Italy, and it harkens back to what was a book of the summer for me, I recall, a number of years ago, your wonderful book on American capitalism. Describe European capitalism right now. Help our European listeners with what capitalism is in Europe. I really can't figure out a good definition.
Actually, it's very different across countries. And I would say that it is one, in this moment, one advantage of the Europe over the United States is that they seem to enforce the rule of competition better than the United States. The antitrust is more aggressive and is less easy to buy out the legislator at the European level. I think it's just a transitional phase. And eventually things will converge in a war state. But at the moment, I think this is an advantage vis-a-vis the United States.
I mean, within it is, I guess, where GDP is, and the whole disappointment here has been where GDP has been in the United States for X number of years, and for Europe and all that as well. A little bit of inflation today reported in Europe. Are you optimistic that we will see a Powell-like inflation lift in America?
I think that my reading of the data is that the lack of inflation is due to the lack of increase in wages. And ironically, maybe we've gone too much the other way. There was a huge pressure to reduce wage, reduce the power of labor, reduce this, reduce that. Eventually, maybe we overshot. And we need to give a little bit more of bargaining power to labor so that wages will go up. And when wages will go up, inflation will go up as well.
Professor, before we lose you, I think what's really stood out to a lot of market participants this week is how quickly liquidity evaporated in some of the world's largest markets, which we would expect to have liquidity at times of stress, and it just was not there. The Italian bond market is one of the largest bond markets on the planet. And what clearly happened this week was a move sparked by politics, but amplified by the complete evaporation of liquidity. How concerning is that for you, Professor? And what's the lesson that we can learn from this week?
It is definitely concerning. It reminds me of the temper tantrum that took place a few years back when Bernanke started to announce that he will start increasing rates. I think that what happened, in my view, is that a lot of people were long on Italian bonds, not because they believed in Italy, just because it was the highest yielding security around. And as a result, we're ready to rush to the door for the first at the first sign of problems. So I think that we are seeing the effects of this reaching for yield, which, is, as we know, tend to be destabilizing. And I think that to some extent, this book has been useful because has warned people that it's not a one-way bet and they can actually lose money. And so I'm sure that they're going to be more careful in the future.
Luigi, one final question, if we could. Have you made plans to attend the World Cup this summer?
One World Cup. They canceled it this year. Don't you know that?
Well, Professor, there is a more important question for you. Would you accept the position as finance minister in Italy if it was offered
that
to you?
That would be a more important question.
Nobody has offered it to me. So you can be reassured that I will be watching the World Cup.
Well, but within this, Luigi, to Mr. Farrow's important question, Carlo Cottarelli has been a wonderful and sustained guest on Bloomberg Surveillance over the years with his fiscal work and original work at the International Monetary Fund. To see Mr. Cottarelli and Zingales in tandem in Italy would suggest lift the spirit of markets. Is that politically feasible in your Italy to have academics associated with this phrase, technocrats, really run the show? Is that feasible?
I don't think that being on Bloomberg is necessarily the step to go and become minister.
That's surely a prerequisite, Luigi.
In your view, I'm sure. But the reality is, actually, I respect Carlo very much. We have different views on many things. So I don't think that all technocrats think the same. And I think that it is important, in my view, to feel the pain that is around in Italy. And I think people underestimate how devastated the country is. 20 years of no growth in per capita GDP, almost 50% of youth unemployment. I think that this is a country that has lost hope. And forget the World Cup. I think that people are not even that upset about that because there are much bigger problems around. And I think that whether you're a technocrat or not, I think that what people want is somebody ruling them that feel that pain.
Now, Professor Zingales, thank you so much for those important comments, particularly on your Italy. We greatly appreciate his attendance. He is of course, with the Booth School, University of Chicago, as well, Luigi Zingales. This is without question our interview of the day, and is without question timely as we may see further tariffs today from the White House. Donald Strazheim, essentially invented China market economics, darkening the door of Merrill Lynch, Wharton Economics, and others over the years, including the Milken Institute. He is with Mr. Hyman over at Evercore ISI and continues a true focus on China. Who was the first premier or president of China that you dealt with professionally? You don't go back to Mao, right?
No, Jiang Zemin, who was in the 90s, he was a smart guy, focused and a consensus builder. Now we are back to Chairman Mao days, a political strongman rule under Xi Jinping. It's not my idea of a good time.
Can you explain to me how Mr. Xi reacts to the bipolar advice that Mr. Trump is getting, maybe personified by one view of free trader Lawrence Kudlow and another by Navarro, singularly saying China is not evil but unfair in their trade?
He listens politely. He and his team, Wang Qishan, who's a vice president, and Liu He, who was a guy at Davos and is in charge of the U.S.-China economic and financial relationship. They listen politely, but they don't react to tweets. They don't react to speeches, to reports. They react to actions. So wait until you see Washington do something, then you react, but not before.
Don, I read this term in the last 24 hours, and I think it was in the LA Times. It was microwave diplomacy. I think it's a fantastic term, microwave diplomacy.
What is that?
Short, quick. You know, we're used to diplomacy happening over time, over years, over decades, with goals over long time horizons. This is very fast, high heat. Does microwave diplomacy work, Don?
I doubt it. I mean, I heat up my my cold coffee in a microwave now, and I guess 20 years ago, if I did it in a regular oven, it would have taken a lot longer. I suppose it still works okay, but I think China looks at Washington, I think, and they see they don't see policy, they see results. They see flip-flop. They don't know which way to move, and so accordingly, they wait until Washington does something, and then they react.
Is it good to keep China on the back foot, and is China on the back foot right now?
I don't think China's on the back foot right now. Some people have said that Washington, I've said that China sees Washington as unreliable and unpredictable, and I think it means unreliable and untrustworthy. This last week, the U.S. said, we will impose the $50 billion worth of tariffs. Will, not maybe.
Yeah.
That's drawing a line in the sand. And maybe being unpredictable as a point guard is okay to go either way, but not in international relations.
Don, the difference here, and John, I just did this in real time, folks. When I say I go to China, it's a bunch of baloney. I get on a plane, I get in a car, I go to some fancy hotel. I'm within a football field of the hotel, a soccer field, John. And then I get back in the fancy car and come home. This time I actually went into China, but I didn't go to Chengdu. How is all this playing across all of industrial China? Not in Beijing, not in Shanghai, not in Hong Kong. How's it playing every place else?
Well, companies throughout China who are involved in international trade, and all are in one way or another, are perplexed. They don't know what to do. There's this great deal of uncertainty because their biggest trading partner in the world is on an uncertain path. So what do you do when you're uncertain? You run in place. You don't make long-term commitments because you don't know whether this step that you take is going to ultimately be a step forward or back.
Within this is the American feeling. A lot of our listeners are saying, right, John, I give John Farrell huge credit for articulating the frustration over their taking of our technology. Liz Economy really features this in her book, The Third Revolution, of how they're appropriating our technology. How do you respond to that? Are they bad guys and that we can't play there unless we give them patent and copyright?
I think China has been a serial intellectual property thief, probably the biggest in the world, the best in the world for a long time.
Yep.
I don't think that's likely to change. Excuse me.
We're all coughing in the room. It can be a hat trick of coughs.
Okay, there you go. That's not going to change in any material way. I think the forced technology transfer is a completely that's a non-item. No company is forced to operate in China, but if they do, they have to follow China's rules. No companies, Chinese companies are not forced to operate in the U.S. If they do, they're going to follow the U.S. rules. So I think that's a non-item. And 301 tariffs are not going to help this. They are a step back. They are a lose-lose, not a win-lose or a lose-win or a win-win. They are a lose-lose.
Lose-lose is the Red Sox strategy.
Both sides.
They're not forced to operate there, though, Don. But the problem arises when the barriers to entry for Chinese companies into the United States are much lower than the barriers to entry for the United States into China. And I think it makes sense that we have an administration in the United States that tries to level the playing field. That makes sense, surely.
Sure, sure.
Isn't that what they're trying to do?
I think that is what they are that they're trying to do. We'll see how successful they are at it. China has a very different strategy. They have state capitalism, unlike ours. It has its pluses and minuses.
Within this, Don Strezheim, if you're just joining us with Evercore ISI, Donald Strezheim, within this is the labor arbitrage that Steve Roach has talked about at years at Morgan Stanley and now Yale, which is that marginal labor dollar in China migrating to Vietnam. Migrating to other Asian geographies, maybe Malaysia, is one example. Give us an update on how China competes at a more advanced labor wage.
Well, this is exactly what is happening. But this is not new. Is the medium skill manufacturing jobs, the low skill manufacturing jobs, are migrating, have migrated to the lower wage economies. That will continue on from Vietnam to Africa and so forth. At the high end, my own view is our U.S. K-12 education system is completely broken. China's is the best in the world. And what China has more than anything else is human capital that is of great value and importance.
All we got is a minute and a half left with you, Don Strezheim. I want to talk about pollution. Can a totalitarian structure find the incentives to diminish air and water pollution, or is that really what an open capitalistic system is good at?
Either side can do that. China, I think, does not use the pricing tool
correct
as well as they could on environment.
Can they use the force tool? Can they force cleaner air?
Sure, they can. And they are doing that. And I will tell you that I think the most important economic dynamic in China for the next 20 years is environmental preservation and remediation. They know they have to clean it up. They have to do that for their own self-preservation.
Is it cleaning up at the margin? Is it finally getting better?
Air quality in 50 cities in China, biggest ones are down. Air quality index is down 40% from 5 years ago. It's still bad, but it's much better than it was.
Terrific
and it
review.
Continues to improve.
Don Strezheim, thank you so much with Evercore ISI on China. Gino Martin Adams with him. We're going to really dig down here now into much more technical discussion of the equity markets. We do this for the CFA crew, staggering to late June in CFA 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Where in the accounting statement is the dynamics that interest you the most in American corporations?
I think it's a really good question because what we've seen over the last several years is actually a migration of investor attention up the income statement
toward sales,
toward the balance sheet, right? So investors are actually paying for sales beats and discouraging sales misses more so than they're paying for earnings beats and discouraging earnings misses in stock price reactions. Mm-hmm. We also see over the longer term companies that are reporting consistent and robust sales growth. So companies with five-year average sales growth that exceeds the market are outperforming companies with five-year slower sales growth. And we're not seeing that extreme distinction on the part of earnings. You see it with cash flow as well. So cash flow like sales toward the top, the upper end of the income statement, definitely providing performance. And then I also think the other thing to talk about is the balance sheet. And what we've seen over the last year in particular is investors paying up for companies with lower debt, or lower leverage ratios, and certainly punishing companies that have utilized debt to a large degree, to the extent that their debt to EBITDA is above average, and especially the companies with debt to EBITDA ratios well above average have actually underperformed substantially.
From where you sit, the synthesis of all of Bloomberg Intelligence, what is the dynamic if yields lift to that debt burden? It's not linear. It's quadratic by definition.
Not. It is.
Are we anywhere near where it has an inertial force that really causes angst?
Not yet, because a lot of the debt is actually secured at long-term low interest rates that do not reset. So the positive aspect of this is
there's less
is that,
floating and more fixed
exactly.
coupon.
Exactly. So even though rates are going higher, the companies are not experiencing a tremendous amount of pressure on their current debt. They can certainly sustain payments on that debt with earnings accelerating. Right. The problem becomes later in the cycle, if rates reset higher on a more permanent basis, say 5 years from now, when companies go back to tap the debt markets, they're going to have to pay a lot more for new debt. They're going to have to pay a lot more for that maturing debt to refinance the debt. The other thing that I think is really interesting is in the tax package that was passed in December, there's inherently a component of it that disincentivizes debt use. Because companies have been able to write off their interest expense, when it comes to their tax bills for several years now, there's been a tremendous incentive to utilize debt, which explains partially at least why debt has grown as much as it has. As part of the tax component or tax package this year, they'll only be able to write off 30% of that interest expense, 30% to the extent that that interest expense is a percentage of underlying earnings. And going forward, that will be the percentage that they can write off will become less and less over time.
So they disincentivize
them. Yeah, so we're starting to disincentivize debt, which, you know, depends on if this tax reform becomes permanent, right? There's a lot that can happen in the next several years. But I think as rates rise, if we are going to continue to disincentivize debt, that could very much change the funding structure of companies as well. Something to look out for in the longer term.
Where is the tax dividend going?
The tax dividend, so the extra cash. Yep. Yeah, it's for the most part so far going toward capital spending plans, right? I wouldn't go so far as to say that we've actually deployed a lot of that extra cash or the savings from tax. Initially, companies suggested that they were going to pay it out in the form of wage increases, bonuses, one-time bonuses to employees. And through the course of the first quarter earnings season, which we just completed, what we found is companies starting to announce capital spending plans en masse.
Yep.
We saw the capital spending, the next 12 months capital spending growth is now expected to accelerate 18%, for example. And we've been running at a pace below 10% for the last year or so. So there is an evolution of potential CapEx growth playing out through the earnings stream, the company announcements. There's a little bit of buyback growth, so they are starting to deploy it back to shareholders, though I'd say that it's pretty slow in coming, and it's very narrow. Not that many companies are announcing it, though we are seeing buyback growth accelerate.
Yeah.
And some companies, such as energy companies, for example, have really been ahead of this. They've started to deploy capital in the form of buybacks and dividends, where they hadn't in past years.
So this sounds positive on the debt side because there might be less issuance, and on the equity side because it should lengthen the cycle. If we do get this CapEx story and supply side response.
Yeah.
When you have a fragile story internationally in EM, now increasingly so in Europe too, do we see a Buy America theme come back into this market in a way that we had things in, say, the back end of 2016, early 17?
Oh, it's interesting because we have actually seen that. The small cap stocks have outperformed tremendously.
Yeah.
And we talk about large cap stocks have sort of been stuck in this malaise for the last 2 weeks, just stuck at their 100-day moving average. Relatively volatile on recent news, but small caps are making new highs. Micro cap stocks are making new highs. So the companies that are more domestically focused, the companies that benefit when the dollar rallies, that are more sheltered from international risks, are absolutely doing better.
Is that also going to mean a switch from growth to value as well, given that those growth names are international by definition on the S&P 500?
So normally it would, and it really intriguingly has not yet. So you would think that the recovery in small caps, the recovery in dollar-focused companies, the recovery in the domestic names would start to produce a shift in value stocks in the S&P 500. And we have not seen that en masse yet. As a matter of fact, the financials in the S&P 500 have been one center of extraordinary weakness in this environment. It's a big conundrum.
Top
because
line
the
will
financials
circle back.
And,
circle back to the income statement. Yeah. Is that? I mean, Charles Peabody has been brilliant on this. At Portel, Peabody was bullish, looked like a genius. He flips to more negative. Now he looks like a genius. And is it because of a real question of revenue shortfall?
I think it is. For the top line companies, that's at least part of it. But yeah, the financials and the small caps are doing very well.
Okay.
So what I think is happening is the small cap financials are doing well because they're perceived to benefit from a deregulation wave. They're also still lending and lending to lower credit quality borrowers, where the large caps have been extraordinarily conservative and they're exposed to more. They're exposed to the international story and they're not producing that extraordinary top line.
1 minute left with all of your experience at Wells Fargo and now at Bloomberg is simply, what is the pixie dust of Amazon where they're valued not on profits?
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
I think it comes from a desire for long-term secular growth. So there is
industry capture.
Yeah, there is a belief that a certain subset of companies are going to produce long-term secular growth prospects that don't exist elsewhere in the index, elsewhere in the economy. Mm-hmm. And those companies are largely concentrated in the internet space as a big theme. Amazon is one of them. Facebook is another. Twitter is another. Right. So you've got this whole subset of companies that has this investor following because of their long-term outlook. Which doesn't exist in a lot of places.
Well, we've got to have you back before the CFA exams. We're going to do 5-ratio DuPont analysis with Gina Martin Adams here in about 10 days. You can, Colin and the twins.
I had to explain what BTPs were, and you get to say that.
I think that's a good point. Michael Barr, I think I've been checked there by Mr. Farrell.
What on earth did you just say?
We call that shade.
That was like Big Chef's 5-ratio shade right there. Gina Martin Adams, head of all of equities, Bloomberg Intelligence. Thrilled to have her. Deutsche Bank cannot find a bid. It's as simple as that. 4 days ago, we're down a good 10%, almost 11%. On a euro basis, we are at 10 and change, down to about 990. With the news, the FT article, that we have Deutsche Bank as a problem bank. We've moved 985, and we're now trying to find a bid at 935 on Deutsche Bank. Catherine Mann with us right now. We're going to continue with this discussion, even as we want to talk banking. Of course, Dr. Mann cannot speak to us about financials and banks in particular, but there's too much else to talk to Kathy Mann about at this moment. I have to rip up the script, Dr. Mann, and go back to your iconic book, Is a Trade Deficit Sustainable? Mr. Trump believes it is sustainable. In this moment where we may see new and complex tariffs across different nations from the White House, if Donald Trump was to read your classic small book, easily digestible on 3 plane trips, what would he learn? What does he need to learn from your classic, Is a Trade Deficit Sustainable?
So I think he needs to learn that there are two sides of the trade deficit. One is, of course, the goods and services, but the other side is capital flows, and the two sides of the same coin. And if you try to squeeze one side through protectionist measures, you have to be concerned about what signal that sends to financial markets about the welcoming nature of business in the United States. So I think that that's the important ingredient, because you can't be protectionist on the side of trade and at the same time welcome international capital flows.
So the surprise then could be dollar dynamics? Is that where we observe his strategy?
Do we see it
with a strong dollar that surprises all?
Well, I think that the strong dollar or the dollar dynamics are driven by a whole lot of things. Relatively stronger U.S. economy right now because of the degree of fiscal stimulus, no question about that, particularly vis-a-vis Europe, which is going through a number of issues. And when we think about the consequences for protectionism, there's a lot of rhetoric out there that is perhaps actually going to be backed up by changes in policy on the steel side, with the new rhetoric on 232 with cars. You know, you've got the issues with Iran.
Right.
And so all of that is tempering the growth in Europe more than right. it is helping the growth in the United States.
Dr. Mann, time for one more question yep. before we go to this important financial story away from your good work at Citigroup. And that is the idea that maybe we've seen coordinated growth, combined growth, ebbing.
Yeah.
Do you observe that across your global mandate?
Well, we've got the synchronized growth rate of the last 2 years continuing for this year. It could continue for next year, but there are cracks in that synchronicity, and that you know is coming from the trade rhetoric and the, possibly the trade war. But it is also coming from financial market turbulence that is part of the normalization of monetary policy,
right.
and that has you know we have to have the normalization of monetary policy. It's been a very long time with very cheap
yes.
money. And so that financial market turbulence and how it translates into the real economy is something that is going to be differential across countries.
Dr. Mann, thank you so much. Catherine Mann, and we're too rude with her today, head of all of global economics for Citigroup, as we have to move on to breaking news. And of course, Kathy Mann there mentions the idea of turbulence. It is a good time to turn to Gerard Cassidy with decades of banking analysis experience with RBC Capital Markets. Gerard Cassidy, wonderful to have you with us today. What does it signal to Deutsche Bank that they have become a problem bank according to the U.S. FDIC?
Is this company has struggled with the CCAR process. As you know, that's the annual stress test that the banks have to go through, and they've not been able to pass it for the last couple of years. So it's no big surprise this news leaked out. Normally these ratings by the bank regulators, they're part of a rating system called CAMEL, which is an acronym, and it's 1 through 5. If you're a 4 or 5, you're a troubled bank, which is apparently what came out this morning, as you pointed out, with Deutsche Bank. So it means that this heavy lifting still to be done so that they get their internal house in order here in the United States.
Gerard, what does this mean to a bank to see the decline in shares? We have a 10% decline off of the pre-Italy moment. There's a fact where the stock price is a stock price. Do institutions, including the boards of directors of a given bank, do they care when they see a stock drop like this, and particularly drop into the single-digit area?
Tom, I think they do. I mean, they have to take notice of any big stock price declines. And so we've seen Deutsche has struggled, as you and I have noticed, over the last many years. And this is just another challenge that they have to confront. And so the steep price decline, of course, is troublesome. It's something that they have to address. Possibly
right.
they'll come out with some public statements to address it.
So what's so important here, and I guess it goes back to the memories of another time and place, not to be inflammatory, which is all slams in Gerard Cassidy to the short-term paper market. Pim Fox likes to talk about counterparty risk and other ideas. Maybe it's commercial paper, short-term paper. Come on, Jerry, it's all about trust. Where's the trust now on the desk of Deutsche Bank?
No, you're right. There's certainly a confidence factor that you have to address. Certainly this company, you know, consolidated, is well capitalized. This is nothing like what we saw.
Yeah, but that's the distinction. Gerard Cassidy, this is important. This is the distinction between liquidity and solvency. Discuss that, please. What's the difference for our audience between a given major bank's liquidity and their solvency?
No, Tom, you're absolutely right. In fact, you know, the liquidity problem was what eventually put Lehman Brothers into the position that they ended up failing. But because of what we saw in 07, 08, Deutsche and all the global banks have addressed the amount of liquidity they need to carry because of the new Basel requirements. So all of our banks, even banks that are considered to be troubled, and with this troubling, too, with what came out, it's, in my view, it looks like it's more the internal internal systems and the internal reporting have to be really improved. It's not a measure of not having liquidity or capital. That is not really the issue. So there's plenty of liquidity here for any, for Deutsche Bank and, again, all our global banks because of what the regulators have done post 2008 and 2009.
But then to go back to the stock price, if you're just joining us, folks, worldwide, we're honored to bring in Gerard Cassidy, RBC Capital Markets, for a few more minutes. Pre-Italy, 10.50 euros, and we're now down to 9.44 euros. We found a modest bid here to be retested in the coming, minutes. Gerard Cassidy, I want to go back to the stock price. Who's selling? Is this hedge funds? Is this speculators? Or is this long-only buy-side institutional clients who are either selling or they're being told by their general counsel to sell?
Yes, it's tough to determine who the sellers are. Certainly, as we've seen, the active traders, the hedge fund traders, certainly will move very quickly on news like this.
Right.
But again, it's hard to really determine, unless there's huge blocks going across and the trading desks tell us, that it was a long only. So it's really hard to determine who's selling. But again, as you know, this company is struggling with many issues. This is just one of the more recent ones, obviously, this morning. But they are still wrestling with how do they downsize their capital markets business and the number of employees
right.
They're going to let go. That is also weighing in on this story.
Very valuable. Gerard Cassidy, thank you so much with RBC Capital Markets on short notice here. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.